Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the role of Trump's friend Rudy Giuliani, who was apparently behind the infamous Comey letter that Hillary Clinton blames for her loss, and examine his latest and sleaziest machination as he now lobbies for the release of Reza Zarrab, Iran's biggest sanction buster, to help out Turkey's dictator Erdogan, who is implicated in profiting from the Turkish-Iranian businessman's racket of selling gold to the Iranians on phony invoices for food and medicine that generated $11 billion in profits. David Phillips, the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at Columbia University and the author of An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship, joins us to discuss how Giuliani and his partner, former Attorney General Mukasey, are trying to get Trump, who fired the U.S. attorney prosecuting Zarrab, to replace Preet Bharara with Mukasey's son Mark, so that he would be in charge of the prosecution of the man his father is trying to get out of jail. Then we will speak with Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch, who served as chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee. He joins us to discuss the investigation by Wells Fargo Bank that led to its announcement that it would claw back $75 million in severance it paid to two senior executives, former CEO John Stumpf and Community Bank head Carrie Tolstead, who presided over the fake account scandal where Wells Fargo customers were ending up with an average of six accounts per household, whether they wanted them or not. Then finally, we'll go to Wichita, Kansas, and speak with Neil Allen, a professor of political science at Wichita State University, to get an update on the special congressional election taking place today to fill the seat left open by Mike Pompeo, who Trump appointed to head up the CIA. With the polls having closed 40 minutes ago, we will look into whether this solidly Republican district could be a bellwether for a Democratic resurgence as resistance to the Trump administration grows. Joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco and is a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
And you have a piece in the Huffington Post that is quite extraordinary, that it turns out that Rudy Giuliani, who's obviously close to Donald Trump and former mayor of New York, of course, that he's now defending the Iranian sanction buster who was working with Turkey. And, of course, the great irony is that last August, when the Obama administration returned $440 million of frozen Iranian money as a part of the Iran deal to shut down their nuclear weapons program, Giuliani called that trading with the enemy. But now he's representing a guy called Reza Zarrab, a Turkish-Iranian, he's a billionaire, right? This guy's actually being charged with trading with the enemy, right?
He's being charged. Rudy Giuliani has joined his legal defense team, but not to represent him in court, but to appeal to the Trump administration to forget the charges and send them back to Turkey. President Erdogan has been directly involved in trying to get the charges thrown out. Reza Zarrab must know something important, otherwise all these people wouldn't be working on his behalf.
Well, aren't there connections with the family? I mean, this guy is the Ayatollah Khamenei's bagman, right? He was the sanctions buster. Under the sanctions, Iran, he was trading gold for foodstuffs and stuff, and he was making, something like $11 billion off these deals? And then the Turkish prosecutors went after a whole bunch of people, I believe, including some of Erdogan's family members, and Erdogan shut him down. Is that a correct reading?
So Zarrab was arrested for the first time in 2013. There were taped conversations implicating Erdogan and his family members in a huge corruption scandal. As a result, a number of ministers were forced to resign. Erdogan never denied the veracity of the wiretaps. Instead, he lamented the fact that the information had leaked out. He also made a huge effort to shield Reza Zarrab. He vouched for his character. He called him a philanthropist whose work had, quote, contributed to the country. His contributions, by the way, included financial donations to a social and economic foundation run by Tayyip Erdogan's wife, Emine. And ultimately, the charges against Zarrab were dropped. The police and the prosecutors involved in the case were all dismissed. So there is a very deeply rooted collaboration between Zarrab and Erdogan that dates back at least to 2013.
Well, he was arrested, was he not, Zarrab? He was arrested at the Miami International Airport when he showed up with his pop star wife and I think to take his kid to Disneyland. And where does the U.S. charges against him stand?
So Zarrab was involved in money laundering to help Iran evade U.S.-imposed sanctions. The U.S. adopted a strategy to prevent Iran from accessing the SWIFT international money transfer system. The way that Iran was able to bypass SWIFT directly involved Zarrab. He would sell foodstuffs, generate revenue, issue false bills, and then the money was used to buy gold, and the gold was transferred to Iran, ostensibly to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which would be using the funds to acquire weapons or to support Iran's nuclear program.
So that's where the U.S. comes in. And where does it stand now in terms of Zarrab's jeopardy? I mean, what's he facing in U.S.
So he's facing decades in jail for a whole variety of wrongdoings. The U.S. attorney in the Southern District, who used to be Preet Bharara before he was dismissed by President Trump, has charged Zarrab with money laundering, defrauding the United States, violating the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which regulates Iran's sanctions. If you total out the potential liability to Zarrab, he could spend the next 30 or 40 years in jail. And that's where he sits right now. He's in the Manhattan Correctional Center. There's a trial date set for August. If the trial goes forward, there's bound to be all kinds of sordid information revealed about Zarrab's connections to Erdogan and the leadership in Turkey. So Zarrab's lawyers and Erdogan himself are making a big push to have the charges dismissed, so Zarrab can be sent home before he sings to the prosecutor.
And again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco and The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the U.S. Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush and Obama. And his latest book is An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. So then, little wonder then that Erdogan has also hired Giuliani's firm. And this is where I think it gets pretty flagrant, doesn't it, David Phillips? Trump just recently fired the U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, who was prosecuting Zarrab. And according to the New York Times, Giuliani has recommended Mukasey, the former Attorney General, who is also weighing in on Zarrab's behalf. He's recommended Mukasey's son, Mark Mukasey, to become the next United States attorney in Manhattan. So if a Giuliani gets his way, then the younger Mukasey would be in charge of the prosecution of the man that his father is trying to set free.
Sounds pretty incestuous. One small correction, though, Ian. Giuliani isn't hired by Erdogan. He's hired by Reza Zarrab. He is coordinating activities with Erdogan. And recently, Giuliani and Mukasey took a trip to Ankara where they discussed representational work on Zarrab's behalf as a member of the legal defense team.
Well, according to an article in Alternet, Erdogan has also hired Giuliani's firm as its agent on other issues. So what do you know about that?
So the law firm where Giuliani serves as a senior counselor to the chairman, called Greenberg Traurig, is a registered foreign agent for the government of Turkey. In this particular instance, I understand that Giuliani is hired by Zarab himself, while his firm has a number of contracts with the Turkish government to represent their interests as lobbyists in Washington.
Well, the other aspect to this, surely, though, is the Michael Flynn story, where my understanding is that the FBI, basically what they're holding over Flynn and why his lawyer is saying he's got a story to tell and is asking for immunity, has not so much to do with the Russian story, but to do with the fact that Flynn, who was paid $500,000 by Erdogan's government, I think it was his Erdogan's brother-in-law, who is, I think, a bagman. I believe he showed up meetings with Flynn, at which they insisted that somehow Flynn find a way to kidnap the cleric, Gulen, who lives here on a green card in an estate in Pennsylvania in an exile, and he is the absolute bête noir of the Erdogan administration, who he's blamed for everything. Erdogan wants to extradite him. The U.S. is not forthcoming in that regard. So my understanding is that these meetings took place where they literally discussed kidnapping and renditioning Gulen to Turkey. And later, of course, the former head of the CIA, James Woolsey, showed up at these meetings and verified that this indeed had happened. But, of course, he went to pains to say it didn't happen while I was in the meetings. So what do you know about that?
So we know that Michael Flynn was paid $530,000 by Turkish interests. It's not clear whether that was government money or government money that was laundered through a Turkish company, but clearly he was working on behalf of the government of Turkey's interest. It's not clear what he was actually being paid to do. He wrote an op-ed, actually on Election Day, where he called for the U.S. to extradite Fethullah Gulen, a geriatric Muslim teacher who lives in the Poconos, whom Erdogan accuses of masterminding the coup. The article also called on the Pentagon to discontinue its security cooperation with the Syrian Kurds, who have proven to be our most effective partners in the battle against ISIS in Syria. It's been reported, and the former CIA head Jim Woolsey has confirmed, that Michael Flynn had discussions about abducting Fethullah Gulen and getting him sent back on a plane to Turkey where he would face treason charges. If that's the case, that's such a gross miscarriage of justice. But frankly, we're seeing a pattern here. Flynn being paid by Turkish concerns to undermine the rule of law and the administration of justice in the United States, and Giuliani also now accepting significant sums to do the same, to jump the queue, try to get the case against Reza Zarab thrown out so that the U.S. prosecutors never hear what he has to say. So there's a pattern of malfeasance and dishonesty among people who are close to President Trump.
But Trump could free Zarab, right?
It's within the purview of the Attorney General to do that. But at this stage in the proceedings, with a trial scheduled for August, it would be a huge miscarriage of justice for the U.S. government to somehow release Zarab and send him home. It would also look as though they were colluding with an Iranian sanctions violator. And given the hard line that Trump has taken on Iran, I don't think he wants to be tarred with that brush.
Well, he's demonstrated lately that he can turn on a dime. So, but let's talk a little bit about Trump turning on a dime. And much of the context of what the Trump administration's been saying. Because most of what Trump says and does is he blames all of his problems on Obama, even though Obama's left office and he's been the president and the Republicans control the House, the Senate, the White House, and now the judiciary. So one wonders why they keep blaming the black guy, but that's nevertheless a pattern here. And of course, the 2013 red line that Obama drew over chemical weapons from which he retreated is the big issue. And Trump's more or less saying, you know, he'd almost boxed himself in, I think, to have to sort of do something because of his criticism of Obama wimping out. But let's focus in on that particular chemical weapons attack in the suburb of Damascus. That was never entirely clear who was behind that. I know Seymour Hersh wrote a story that many people disputed, suggesting it wasn't Assad. I've talked to my friend Graham Fuller, former CIA officer, who actually got Gulen his green card. He said that he thought the MEK was involved, the Turkish intelligence service. What do you know about that? Do you think that there's any ambiguity? Because it's very hard to understand the motives behind this chemical weapons attack. Because one, there was a meeting going on in Europe to give reconstruction money to Assad. Assad's winning the war, so why would he need to attract this kind of international, not that he cares about what the international community thinks, but nevertheless, you wonder why he would do it. So I know I've given you a lot there, but let's start with 2013.
So in August of 2013, there was an attack using mustard and sarin gas against a small city called Ghouta. And more than 1,300 people died as a result of the chemical weapons attack, including women and children. The Obama administration had seen aerial surveillance moving chemical weapons around and knew the attack was coming. So Obama drew a red line, said if Assad used chemical weapons, that would change his calculus. He intended that as a deterrent, but Assad ignored the threat and attacked with CW anyhow. The U.S. didn't want to go to war. Obama had run on a platform of disengaging from wars in the Middle East. So Secretary of State John Kerry floated a proposal that the U.N. should disarm Assad of his nuclear weapons. And that was ostensibly done. Even though, while the disarmament was taking place, there were chlorine bombs that were being used. Now we learn, because of the attack last week, that Assad still possesses sarin and mustard gas. Ostensibly, according to U.S. intelligence, Syrian aircraft took off from a field near Idlib and attacked a community where 80 people died from CW. In response to that, President Trump launched a cruise missile attack using Tomahawk missiles from Navy ships off the coast. And suddenly the whole discussion around Syria changed. Instead of the U.S. media talking about collusion between Trump and Russia to defraud American voters, Trump is now suddenly heralded for standing up against the Russians and protecting Syrians from future chemical weapons attacks. Clearly, the use of the Tomahawk cruise missiles was a big distraction. It didn't achieve any strategic objectives, nor was it linked to any political dialogue. What it did accomplish was to change the topic. So that Trump doesn't have to defend his actions during the campaign, instead focus on events in Syria. And concurrent with that, he's moved a carrier group off the coast of Korea in order to send a message to the Korean leadership that its intercontinental ballistic missile program and nuclear program won't be tolerated. So it seems as though President Trump has discovered a new strategy. When he's facing a problem, he can solve it by creating a bigger one. That's what we did in Syria, and that's what's being threatened in North Korea.
So you think it's unequivocal that the sarin gas was launched by the Syrians, and there's rumors and some evidence, I believe, that the Russians were on that base. There's some accusations that Putin himself may have green-lighted the sarin attack in order to test Trump. Now, just back to the 2013 attack, in Obama's interview with Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic, Obama did say that the intelligence on that 2013 sarin attack outside of Damascus was not a slam dunk. What do you make of that?
So I don't know. I haven't seen the intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
The first part of your statement is true. There were Russian forces on the base from which Syrian planes took off, ostensibly with chemical weapons, munitions, which means that the Russians knew about it. Russia guaranteed the agreement to disarm Assad of his chemical weapons. So from the beginning, it looked as though the deal was a lot of smoke and mirrors. I think we need to see it in a broader political context. Right now, Syria was given a green light by the Trump administration. Just prior to the attack using CW, we saw both Rex Tillerson and Nikki Haley indicate that U.S. policy was not going to focus on getting rid of Assad. Then suddenly Assad uses chemical weapons. We launch these Tomahawk cruise missile strikes. The whole sequence of events is incongruous. And it really raises questions about who did it, what Assad knew, what the Russians knew, and what was Putin's role. These are all questions that are still outstanding.
Well, David Phillips, we will revisit you and revisit those questions, and I thank you for joining us.
And it's always good to speak with you.
Thank you, David. And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco and The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the clawback of $75 million in severance paid to two senior Wells Fargo executives who presided over the fake accounts scandal.
New York, you're perfect. Oh, please don't change a thing. Your mild billionaire mayor's now convinced he's a king. And so the boring collapse. I mean all disrespect. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a bitty, bitty rich, idle, diddle, diddle, diddle man, I'd build.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
It's a privilege to speak with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Bart. And the Wells Fargo did an internal report, which came out yesterday, where they pinned most of the blame for the bank's fraud scandal on two former executives, John Stumpf, the former chief executive, and Carrie Tolstead, the former head of community banking. And they're clawing back $75 million in severance pay to these executives, which amounts to the largest forced return of pay and stock grants in banking history. So would you concur with that, that this is a pretty big deal?
Well, it is notable. If you pause for a minute and say, if you read the actual company's press statement, they say that it's interesting language. They taken executive compensation actions totaling over $180 million. In other words, they don't actually use the word their clawback. And you have to begin and say, $180 million, you mean there was more money left. That is to say, Tolstead and Stumpf still have many dozens of millions of dollars that they were compensated for over the years. It is notable, it is laudable that the bank took at least some action. But, of course, I believe much more needs to be done.
So how much has the bank suffered? Do we know? Because it was such an outrageous thing to do, to set up accounts for customers without telling them and charging them extra fees. And from what I recall when the story broke, that in effect what they did was they fired all the good people who were uncomfortable with it, and who didn't want to meet these unreasonable targets, which they had to be met at the expense of their own customers. And they tried to sort of do a cosmetic house cleaning, effectively getting rid of the whistleblowers. But I don't think they got away with it. And my understanding is that the bank has suffered.
I think it has suffered in terms of reputation and so forth. Among the victims, of course, are the shareholders who thought that those cross-sell, namely the account creation figures, were genuine and they were remarkable. Public Citizen itself documented that they were always up from 1998. They never had a decline. They were always up. You have to wonder if the antenna, such as with Bernie Madoff, should have been up with such consistently aggressive sales numbers. So shareholders suffered when we found out that was built on bogus numbers. Among the things that came out in this report that you just mentioned are the honest employees, if you will. They documented that between 30 and 41% turnover in the workforce per year. Now imagine that. They have a workforce in the community bank of something like 110,000 people. That means 30,000 people left the company, either because they failed to make quota, that they were felt too much pressure to make quota, or somehow things didn't work out. The number of people that were terminated for fabricating accounts is thought to be 5,000. I'm a little skeptical of that number. I don't know how you figure out in a mass of 30,000 employees per year which ones might have fabricated accounts and left the company. But clearly, Wells Fargo, a consumer name, has suffered. It's reflected in the share price. It's reflected in the fact that Wells Fargo is no longer known for the Stagecoach, but is known for fake accounts.
So let's zero in on the people that were fired, that extraordinary turnover. Within that figure, you don't know how many people of conscience were fired who simply, you know, not that they couldn't make these unreasonable goals, which meant they had to con customers, but also, is there any understanding of how many people were either whistleblowers or had a moral conscience?
The 110-page report authored largely by a law firm called Sherman & Sterling doesn't go into those kind of details. It's a 110-page report, which is better than nothing. I would not call it by any means a whitewash. It's been called scathing. I would call it something short of that. It doesn't document those numbers. It said it did 100 interviews. And certainly that's, you know, notable, but I think there are some reporters that do two-part series that interview 100 people. They investigated 1,000 reports, namely these would presumably be reports from people such as employees who are complaining. But again, we're talking about 30,000 people per year that are leaving the company, so I think the report fell quite short of producing the kind of documentation that would answer questions such as yours, namely how many people failed to make quota because they were doing their job correctly and therefore were terminated.
And again, I'm speaking with Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., where he works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. So my understanding, though, is that there have been amongst the what the report was outlining was that ex-workers were filing suit. And these are the people who had been left holding the bag, said a lawyer for the workers. So where does that stand? In other words, are they out of the woods? I mean, it's one thing to claw back money from rewarding these two top bankers with golden parachutes who had overseen either in terms of John Stumpf, apparently turned a blind eye. It's hard to know that he didn't know. And Carrie Tolstead, she apparently was the one who was cracking the whip and as head of community banks, forcing the employees to attain these unreasonable and dishonest goals.
Wells Fargo faces a number of contests ahead. The shareholder meeting is coming up, I believe it's April 25th. The leading proxy advisory services have called for shareholders to vote against the board of directors. One of them says those that served during the time of the problem, and the other calls for the ouster of all the board. Public Citizen has a shareholder resolution calling for a study of the breakup based on the fact that we think the company is too big to manage. Most importantly, there is, we believe, a federal investigation that could lead to a prosecution. And there are at least two things that I think are outstanding in that case. One is fraud by Wells Fargo with respect to these clients. Related to that is what's known as internal controls. The bank has to attest that it is in control of how it's operating. This report itself by Sherman and Sterling attests to the fact that it was not. And then finally, there's the issue of perjury by John Stumpf for two hearings in Congress, Senate and House. Among the things that should be questioned is when he learned about the massive terminations. I believe he said that it was fairly recently. This report itself shows that he was made aware of this as early as 2004, I think, by Tolstead, when she pointed out that some of the sales goals and the incentive compensation structures are leading to inappropriate sales.
Well, but didn't they also, though, smother these lawsuits from customers by moving them into private arbitration?
Yes. Mandatory arbitration, as your listeners will well understand, are these small print clauses in your contract that says that if you have a complaint and you believe that there is a violation of law, you can't go to court. You must submit to a closed-door arbitration. If your claim is small, such as you believe there was a $10 fee that was inappropriate, there is no reason for you to spend the $500 on arbitration. The Wells Fargo did settle a class action lawsuit rather than forcing into arbitration for $110 million, which we certainly welcome. But that the Wells Fargo illustrates clearly the problem with other banks and other commercial firms, that these mandatory arbitration clauses are an invitation for companies to put in little rip-off fees. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has a forthcoming rule that would ban them in financial contracts. Of course, Public Citizen believes they should be banned in or they should be at the discretion of the consumer in all consumer contracts.
But the work that you and others have done at Public Citizen, Bart Naylor, I believe indicates that Wells Fargo's cross-selling mania didn't begin in 2004, as this report that Wells Fargo just commissioned indicates, that it could have gone back as early as 1998.
Yes. We documented that the sales figures were rising suspiciously strongly, dating as far back as 1998. And we think it's a problem at Wells Fargo. We think it may well be a problem with all of the major banks, that they are under tremendous pressure to demonstrate their value to shareholders and put their employees under these horrendous sales quota goals. The problem is clear at Wells Fargo, but if you look at the complaint database, for example, at the CFPB, this same issue rises even more robustly with, or more gravely with, Bank of America.
Well, but the people who work in banks consider themselves members of the middle class, but their pay, they get paid much less than the average workers, do they not? They're kind of not too different from fast food workers in terms of their compensation.
Roughly 30% of bank tellers are on some form of government assistance. They are so poorly paid.
30%?
Roughly.
Wow. So next time you go up to your smiling teller who says, "How are you having a nice day? How's your day going today?" and all that kind of stuff, which they're trained to say, that's worth keeping in mind, that one in three of them are on some kind of government assistance. Yeah, because the bank won't pay them a living wage, right?
J.P. Morgan, for example, a similar size to Wells Fargo, more than 200 and some thousand employees. And yes, 2,000 people get more than $1 million a year at J.P. Morgan. But again, about a third of the tellers, which is the line, and the line workers, which is the lion's share, are, you know, just a little bit above minimum wage. $15 an hour is the starting wage at Wells Fargo, and that's an increase.
So where does this come from then? I mean, what happened with Stump reminds me of what happened at Volkswagen, where the guy in charge was this, you know, arrogant SOB who, you know, supposedly turned a blind eye to how they were rigging the emissions tests on the diesel engine, and they'd set it that it only came into play when it was being tested, but for the rest of the time it was spewing out nitrous oxide. Now, it's a similar situation, isn't it, where he had to step down. He got a massive multi-billion dollar, I think, payout, but he claims that he didn't know what these engineers were up to. Do you see a similarity there?
It is possible, and some of the accounts of the report pin the problem on Carrie Tolstep, the head of the Community Bank Division, that she was stifling relaying some of the reports. But if you carefully read the Sherman and Sterling report, there were a number of alarm bells from a number of departments, risk, audit, legal department, about some of these terminations for fake accounts and other risk controls. Some of it is true, some of it didn't reach the board, but some of it did, or at least was available to the board. So, for example, the Los Angeles Times reported this in 2013, and it's still about a half year later before the board begins to take this more seriously. So, again, we think the bank is too big to manage, that there are probably a sizable number of risk items that the board and senior management apparently fails to dig into. That's another one of, I think, the key findings. It's not highlighted in the Sherman and Sterling report. The key findings is that the cross-sell forgery was one of many risk items that went to the board, and yet we shareholders and the public haven't really heard what those others are. So apparently serious problems are not uncommon at Wells Fargo, and yet it doesn't come to light.
Right, but how blind was the board of Wells Fargo not to notice that the CEO, John Stumpf, who's just had some money clawed back, although it looks like he's still keeping an awful lot, he bragged in 2014 that Wells Fargo customers had an average of 6.17 accounts per household. Now, who needs to have six bank accounts?
Right.
I mean,
You say blind. I would say asleep. I mean, there is a motivation not to to raise questions on a board. They're being paid, $250,000 a year. And if they were beginning to ask a lot of questions at board meetings, that sort of ruins the mood and delays the time before they get to go to dinner.
And I take it that's pretty common across the board in corporate America.
I unfortunately think it is. I think boards of directors are in fact window dressing when when they really need to be asking very difficult questions and granular questions, as should have been the case in this cross-selling forgery.
Mm. Well, I was reading today about a new book that's coming out, Golden Passport, about Harvard Business School and the effect that it's had on corporate America. I don't know whether you've noticed that at all, but it's sort of, I'm looking forward to reading it, but it sort of indicates from what I could read of the sort of brief review is that there is a kind of reason why we have these kind of sociopaths in corporate America and on Wall Street who seem to be devoid of humanity and completely money-driven. And I think the President of the United States fits that psychological profile as well. And he went to Wharton, which is another one of these hard-charging business schools like Harvard Business School. So do you think that there is some kind of conditioning going on there with all of these kind of military metaphors that they teach in business school, like take no prisoners, slash and burn, etc.?
Well, I do believe, this is a personal belief, that if the point of your work is simply to make money, then you are less likely to be interested in the product and how consumers feel about the product. In other words, my kids are interested in medicine, and I'd like to think they're interested in that because they would like the satisfaction of trying to make people well. Similarly, I would like to think that people that go into the high tech are trying to make cool applications or are fascinated by computers. But some people, and especially with Wall Street, I think the point of Wall Street for people going there is to make money. And once it becomes clear that making money is the goal as opposed to customer satisfaction, then it's a very near step to begin to step across the boundaries of what is appropriate and sometimes even what is lawful. So it both attracts or it self-selects for people that are maybe less socially conscious.
Well, just in closing, Bartonella, it seems unlikely that the Trump administration is interested in anything that we're talking about or anything that's happening with Wells Fargo. I mean, you've got, it's almost the entire, half the cabinet are Goldman Sachs alumni, aren't they?
Well, the pinwheel that is the Trump administration comes around occasionally to Public Citizen's point of view. They said some welcoming things about Glass-Steagall, but then it turns again and they talk about getting rid of all the Wall Street reform stuff. If you understand the Trump administration or can predict it, then I certainly would like to talk to you because I continue to be baffled and, at the very least, profoundly and sadly concerned.
Yeah, but Gary Cohn, whose stock apparently is rising at Steve Bannon's expense, and Steve Bannon, of course, was a minor player at Goldman Sachs where Gary Cohn was a big deal. He used to support Democrats, liberal Democrats and liberal causes until
sure.
Dodd-Frank, and then he became a Republican because that's his jihad is against Dodd-Frank from what it looks like. So,
well, I think he oversaw trading, and the Volcker Rule, Section 619 of the Dodd-Frank Act, takes a big shot at some of the trading operations that he oversaw at Goldman Sachs.
Right, but I think that indicates that Dodd-Frank could be in trouble, right?
Yes, I think Dodd-Frank is in trouble. In fact, what makes America safe, clean, stable is in trouble with what we're seeing from the Trump administration so far.
Right, and that may soon apply to the rest of the world. So I thank you very much, Bartlett Naylor.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's the Financial Policy Advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the Principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as Chief of Investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. We're going to take a restation break. We're back and go to Wichita, Kansas, to get an update on the special election in the solidly Republican district.
That's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustle.
hustling, bustling, getting low. Motion is perpetual. We call drill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say by slow. Dudes, don't let them play us. Girls, they are. Don't need to change the future's odd. You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your gold, give us your gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Neil Allen, who's a professor of political science at Wichita State University, where he teaches courses on American politics, civil liberties, and the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Neil Allen.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Neil. And you're in Wichita, Kansas, home of the infamous Coke Industries. But also,
Yes, I actually in my office, and I'm looking at Coke Industries right now at my window.
Oh, you are? Well, their spokesperson seemed to indicate that they were a little bit worried. Already, I guess, we got two of 260 precincts counted so far. That's 1%. And it has Thompson at 61.5% and Estes at 37%. Now, that would be a shock if it weren't so statistically insignificant, right?
That would. And also, most of those votes are from Sedgwick County, which has Wichita, which does have some fairly Democratic areas in pretty much all elections. But if this election is even close, it says something really profound about what's going on in America.
And when do you think we'll know?
It'll probably be a couple hours or more. And here in Sedgwick County, we have new voting machines that are debuting today. And so that kind of thing might slow things down a good bit.
And the three candidates in this race to replace Pompeo, Mike Pompeo, who is a Tea Party Republican, who Donald Trump appointed as head of the CIA, I think didn't he win by some extraordinary 31%, didn't he? In the last election?
Yeah,
31 points.
The Democrats haven't been above 40% in this district since 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump won by, I believe, 30-something points. And also, the kind of voters that seem to be swinging toward the Democrats, high education, high income voters, we don't have a whole lot of those around here. This is a fairly working class sort of town.
Where Republicans outnumber Democrats by 2-1, right?
Yes, and Democrats really haven't held this district since 1994,
right,
as well.
Right.
But the Democrat here, James Thompson, is running a fairly active campaign. He hasn't raised a huge amount of money, although a lot over the weekend, but certainly more active than Democrats have been recently. And the Republican, Ron Estes, has been pretty underwhelming as a candidate. And we had Ted Cruz here yesterday. Both Trump and Pence have recorded robocalls, so the national Republicans are clearly worried about this district.
Well, I did see an ad for Ron Estes, the Republican, where he's wading in a swamp. And I'm not sure that, it's an ironic message. Obviously, it worked on the campaign for Donald Trump. We're going to drain the swamp. But there's not a lot of evidence that anything's happening. I mean, you just have to look at Mar-a-Lago over last weekend, Trump's private estate down there, a club at which it costs you $200,000 to be a member. And Bill Koch, the oldest of the Koch brothers, was there with David Koch, and Trump dropped by the table for a chat. But that's pretty rarefied atmosphere that Trump moves in. Hardly the kind of world that draining the swamp implies.
That's true. Although we have to remember that in pretty much every public polls recently, Trump has been polling around 85% among Republican identifiers.
Mm-hmm.
And if we get normal turnout here, that would be enough to win by itself. But what makes this a possibly competitive election is that Democratic intensity seems to be so much higher than Republican intensity.
Well, that's a shift because Barack Obama once said that Democrats almost have a genetic problem with voting in midterms. They always turn out for presidential elections, but not for midterms. And of course, these special elections have an even lower turnout than midterms, don't they?
Very much so. I looked at the numbers for, there was a special election in 2005 in a Cincinnati area Republican district where the Democrat almost won. And there they only had about 100,000 voters, which would be maybe a third of normal turnout. And that was a fairly high-profile special election. We'll be lucky to get to 100,000 votes here, where we had 250,000 in November. So, and Democrats usually don't do well in those kind of elections. But Republicans might be a bit demoralized because Trump has not brought the kind of change that they were looking for, or really any change whatsoever in terms of public policy. And the Democrats, have, I think around here, like Democrats across the country, are seeing how important political action is.
Again, I'm speaking with Neil Allen, who is a professor of political science at Wichita State University, where he teaches courses on American politics, civil liberties, and the Supreme Court. So let's talk a little bit about, since you're looking out the window at Koch Industries, how much do they dominate the town of Wichita?
Well, not as much as you might think. I mean, we have a lot of different kinds of employment here. We do a lot of health care because we're the one city in a kind of 100-mile radius around. The aircraft industry is still the biggest employer in town, although it doesn't employ anywhere near what they used to and has been hurt by foreign competition. But Kochs are a pretty big presence. Their philanthropy around town is pretty substantial and seems to be following a kind of the wealthiest person in town. And actually here at Wichita State University, the Kochs give us a lot of money, but it doesn't have strings like it does at a lot of places. So they tend to be giving money to us and to areas around just because they're the wealthy people here in Wichita. But there's lots of people that work for Koch, and they're a huge presence here. And also, they've been increasing in employment over the last decade or so while the aircraft plants have been decreasing.
And the aircraft plants, is it Cessna or Piper?
We have Beech and Cessna were both founded here in Wichita, although they are now merged again together because they're both owned by the same Chinese company, Textron. We have a Boeing split off called Spirit, and then lots of small aviation companies. Mm-hmm. Here at Wichita State, we actually now have a bunch of Airbus workers who are headquartered on campus. But it's still the driver of the local economy. But like so many manufacturing sectors, it just doesn't employ the number of line workers that it used to.
And what do people at Koch Industries do? What kind of reputation for being in the kind of fossil fuel extractive industries?
The headquarters are here, so there's a lot of the kind of financial jobs, mm-hmm. a lot of lawyers. Also, they have a pretty active chemistry unit that's doing product development because, you know, they're in all kinds of sectors, not just oil and gas, paper towels, for example. And so, but a lot of the headquarters work is here because the Koch family is from here. I actually drive past every morning driving my daughter to school, the Koch family compound where Charles still lives.
So back to the race that has, you know, the eyes of the nation are upon you, Neil, whether you like it or not. And I don't know whether it's a false hope on the part of the Democrats to think that they could pull off an extraordinary upset like this, but we will see. The DCCC, the Democratic Campaign Committee, haven't given the Democrat James Thompson, he's a civil rights. What is he? A civil rights lawyer?
He's a local civil rights lawyer and does trial work. He's actually an alum of my department many years ago, and is was homeless for a while actually, and went into the army, put himself through college on the GI Bill, went to law school, and does legal work here. He won the nomination at a committee, I think only had 40 people in it because of the way the special election works, mainly because he was kind of the proxy candidate for the Sanders wing of the party, narrowly beat a more establishment candidate who'd been a state representative. And Thompson is running a pretty active campaign. He's making a lot of his veteran status in his advertisements. He has a lot of firearms. He's shooting an AR-15 in all of them, which would work around here because Wichita is a traditionally working class area where gun ownership and certain kind of conservative values are pretty important. Union membership used to be a driver of voting with the Machinists Union, but they are very weak compared to where they used to be.
And James Thompson has raised, what, about $250,000 in small donations?
That was actually by the first reporting period, but he's raised about that much money or more just over the weekend since the national news caught that the National Republican Party was worried. So and so the Thompson campaign is running about, you know, there's so many advertisements on radio that you click from one station to another and the same Thompson ad is on. And Estes hasn't raised that terribly much money, only $250,000 by the last reporting period, which is not a terribly good number for a Republican in a district like this.
But the Republicans, unlike the Democrats who are not spending any money, the Republican Party has put in $120,000 in the last few days, and they dispatched Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Ted Cruz, and they also have Donald Trump doing robocalls and tweeting out that Ron Estes is running today for Congress in the great state of Kansas. A wonderful guy. I need his help on health care and tax reform, tax cuts reform. So it does look as if the Dems aren't ponying up, whereas the Republicans, if they're worried, even if they, you know, they're even stepping up to the plate here, that's pretty unusual in itself, isn't it?
It is, and also the national party committees try to avoid spending a lot of money in a special election that's not going to be close, and also, if you're going to spend money in a special election in this cycle, the one to spend it on is the Georgia 6th. Which is the opposite kind of district of this one, which is has more college graduates than any district in the country, is in the northern suburbs of Atlanta. And there the Democrat has raised something like $8 million already. And that race looks to be almost even right now. And even the Montana at-large, which will be the next one, is a little more fertile ground for the Democrats than the Kansas 4th. But there might be something pretty serious going on across the country in that there might be a reaction against the Trump administration, and also there might be a decline in enthusiasm of core Republicans as the Trump administration really hasn't been giving people what they promised.
Well, but it's always about turn-up, and the Republicans are great at getting turnout. The Democrats aren't, particularly in midterms and in these...
That's true, although... Also, in Kansas, the Republican Party is really on its heels. The Governor Brownback is about the most unpopular governor in the country. There's a massive budget hole because of tax cuts. Democrats have gained a bunch of seats recently, and moderate Republicans have taken out a bunch of conservatives in primaries. The big tax increases have been passing both houses of legislature, and they've almost overrode Brownback's vetoes. So Thompson, the Democratic candidate, is trying to tie Estes, the Republican, as much as he can to Governor Brownback. And the Republicans are just lucky they didn't nominate a state legislator because the state legislative Republicans are tremendously unpopular. I mean, Trump is actually significantly more popular here than Governor Brownback.
Well, just in closing, Brownback's up for election in 2018. Could that be...
He's term limited.
Oh, he's term limited, is he?
Yes, but that doesn't mean the Democrats won't try to talk about Brownback constantly.
Right,
but year and a half.
Does that mean in 2018, which is a key, obviously, midterm, it could be a shift in the famous state that the famous book was written about? What's the matter with Kansas?
it could be very true. And also, midterms are usually pretty bad for a party of a president, and it's usually because the president starts popular and ends about with the current popularity of Trump. But if he drops off another 10-15% like most presidents do over this cycle, then we might be seeing a wipeout that might make 2006 look tame.
Well, Neil Allen, I thank you very much for joining us here.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Neil Allen, who's a professor of political science at Wichita State University, where he teaches courses on American politics, civil liberties, and the Supreme Court. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.